every other book in the Bible, could you think of something right off the top of your head? You got it. The book of Esther does not mention God. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. So the book of Esther, that's where we are, lesson 16 in our series of the Old Testament. The title of the book, Esther, is probably taken from the name Ishtar, which we'll look at again later. But unlike many of the other books in the Old Testament, this book throughout history has only been known as Esther. It's not been named something else, split in half, combined with other books, mangled and put all over the Old Testament, trying to make it fit. It's been Esther since the beginning of when it was written. And together, Esther and Ruth are the only two books of the Bible named after women. So the important fact is then that this is the only book of the Bible in which God's name is not mentioned. Now, it's a strange fact, but it's true, and I think not mentioning God's name creates a very interesting perspective on the book that we'll discuss later. Also a very interesting perspective on life. So when I was reading this book, because I did try to read it before I taught it, it struck me that Esther is something a little bit like a divine chess game, hence the subtitle. Why a divine chess game? Well, in chess, the true master is able to predict and counteract his opponent's moves even before his opponent has begun to make them. And I think if you look at the book of Esther, time and time again, God demonstrates his ability to know what Satan is going to do well in advance and already be preparing people to counteract and protect his people Israel from the attacks of Satan. God is working in anticipation of these events for the Jews' defense. One of those is when he allowed Mordecai to discover the plot against the king and thereby forestalled Satan's attempts to destroy Mordecai by Haman later. Another time is when God brought Esther into the role of queen in a way that was very hard necessarily to trace back to God's provision for Israel in the future time. I mean, that probably wasn't Esther's primary choice, primary direction in life, wanting to go into be the queen of Persia. But God raised her up into this position in anticipation of the time when Haman would attack the Jews as a way to defend against them. Now, when I say that it's a chess game, I don't mean to say that there's ever any possibility that God could have lost, because that's not who God is. But I'm saying that rather to show the ineffectiveness of Satan's tactics in his endeavors to attack God. In the book of Job, which we will study next week, we can see that Satan requires God's permission before he can even lay a finger against God's people. So Satan was fighting a losing battle all throughout this book, even before he began to make his moves. But he still tried, and the trying was what seemed like a big obstacle, and it's what seems like a big obstacle for us. So I think we find a lot of similarities between us and the people, or the Jews, in Esther. In summary, I think the book of Esther shows that the unseen but obvious hand of God foresees and forestalls Satan's antagonizing of his people. So often we see the losing battle that Satan is trying to start and think it's the whole story. It's very easy to do that if circumstances overwhelm you very quickly and you find yourself looking at everything that's happening without realizing the circumstances around what's happening, the context of what's happening. Why is it then that the tendency of us as people is to only look at the negatives instead of the positives? That's the question I've asked myself in preparing for this lesson. Esther proves that God can use even the most normal daily events of our lives to work miraculously against Satan's tactics. The obstacles may be large, they may seem insurmountable, but the fact is they're not the full story, because God is always working. I wouldn't imagine that Esther, a Jewess, really wanted to become the queen of Persia and live the rest of her life in a harem. That would seem like a pretty large obstacle, I would think. But yet, it was in God's will to use her then as an instrument for God's deliverance of the Jews. Who was the author of the book? I believe the author was probably Mordecai. Other men have been proposed as possible authors, including Nehemiah and Ezra, as I discovered when I was learning about the book myself, but I believe Mordecai is a better and more logical choice for two reasons. Number one, he is clearly an eyewitness of these events. And then secondly, I'll have you open your Bibles and turn to Esther chapter 9, and we'll look at verses 20 and 23, 29 to 32. He's clearly a very capable man who could have created a written record of these events. So Esther chapter 9, starting in verse 20. Esther 9, verse 20. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month, Adar, and the 15th day of the same yearly, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, and from mourning into a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them. So Mordecai was the actual author of the original command to the Jews to keep what became known as the Feast of Purim. And skipping down again to verses 29 through 32, then Esther the queen, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew, wrote with all authority to confirm the second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim in their times appointed, according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves and for their seed the matters of the fastings and their cry, and the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. So I think there at the very end especially, you find what is the record of the book of Esther being written. So all the events leading up to the proclamation of the feast, the actual proclamation of the feast, and then the record that the book was written. And that's done under Mordecai and Esther's direction. But since the kings and queens in ancient times weren't very commonly known to actually write a document so much as stamp it into law, thereby being the author, even though somebody had actually written it for them, I think Mordecai was probably the author in conjunction with Esther. The book was probably written by Mordecai and Esther, two Jews high in the Persian hierarchy, to commemorate the first observance of the Feast of Purim, Lots. The book of Esther refers to a book in which this decree by Esther was written. We read that in verse 9:32. Now, what is the Feast of Purim? Well, this is a Jewish celebration that began at this time, the time of Esther, and it is still celebrated today. It is also a commemoration of God's deliverance of the Jews from Haman's plot, in a similar way that God delivered the Jews from Egypt, and the Feast of Passover commemorates that circumstance. As you read through the book, there are really four primary people. Two that work for good, one that works for evil, and then one that is kind of the facilitator of everything that happens. The first man is Mordecai. Mordecai's name is actually Babylonian, and it means follower of Marduk, which is kind of strange to find the hero being named this, because Marduk was the chief god of Babylon, who may have eventually morphed into the same rough character as Baal from the Phoenician pantheon. If you remember several weeks ago, we discussed that in more detail when we were going through Judges in those earlier books of Israel's history. But both he, Baal, and Marduk were gods of fertility and storms. Marduk, however, was also associated with the planet Jupiter. And then his association with that planet might be what makes us associate Jupiter, the god in the Greco-Roman culture, with the planet today. However it worked, Baal, Jupiter, and Marduk occupied roughly the same place in these ancient pantheons. And after the events of Esther, it wasn't until these events that the name really became what is considered a Hebrew name. It's considered a Hebrew name today, even though its origin was Babylonian. Mordecai is important in the book of Esther because he was the first to recognize the divine providence in the arrangement of events. Esther's name came from one of two sources, either the Persian name for a star, which was Stara, or the Babylonian name for the goddess of love, Ishtar. Now, from earlier, you know, I believe it was Ishtar, and I think that's supported by Mordecai's own Babylonian name, which reflected a god from their pantheon, and also because Mordecai raised Esther from a very young child. So it to me makes sense to believe that they both of their names came from this pagan pantheon. Esther, in her Hebrew name, however, meant myrtle. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, and that's given in chapter 2 and verse 7. Esther is important because she became the new queen of Persia when King Ahasuerus removed her predecessor for denying his request. And perhaps she is the most important character of the story because it was she who was placed into a role that God could use to save his people. Even though she did not recognize that role, or she refused to recognize that role until Mordecai brought it to her attention. The third character, the third important person, is King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus is the royal figure that acts as a facilitator throughout the book. Everything that happens passes through his hands and with his approval, whether or not he really knew the full implications. At the beginning, he was the puppet of Satan through Haman to attack the Jews, but subsequently, he became God's tool to assist in bringing out their salvation. From the information contained in the book, it's difficult to discern what his true thought on the whole situation was. Some people that I've read, some commentators, suggested that the book of Esther recounts his conversion to a roughly Christian faith, but I don't know that you can necessarily find that information in the book in support of that opinion. The fourth character, and the one who is solely evil, is Haman. Satan's tool for mischief would be a good name for him, I think. The character that Satan manipulated throughout the whole story to bring about the primary conflict. Although he is an evil man controlled by greed and lust for power, I think it's very easy to feel just a little bit of sympathy for him. Let's go ahead and read chapter 6 and verse 13. Chapter 6 and verse 13. You ever in life get going along a path and then suddenly something happens and you realize, oh, I think I bit off more than I can chew? Well, I think Haman might have begun to realize that about chapter 6 and verse 13. A little bit of backstory here. Haman was intending to kill Mordecai, but that night, the night before he went in to get the king's permission to kill this man, the king couldn't sleep and remembered what Mordecai had done to save him from an assassination plot. The king then wanted to reward Mordecai, so Mordecai wound up being honored throughout the entire city by Haman. And at the end of this time, taking Mordecai through the city on the king's horse, proclaiming that this was the man that the king wanted to honor, the man that Haman wanted to kill, Haman rushes back to his house with his head covered because he didn't want to be seen, and his wife tells him this. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, "If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him." So, you know, I don't know if I don't know what was going through Haman's mind. We're not told. But if it were me, I think I'd be thinking, I might have gone a little bit too far on this one. Well, Haman was stuck, and he was, to the end, Satan's tool. The background of the book of Esther really begins with the king Ahasuerus. And this Ahasuerus is the one that many people commonly believe was the same as the Persian king Xerxes I. So if he was, then Ahasuerus began ruling around 486 BC, and he planned and executed an invasion of Greece about 3 years later in 483 BC. The events of Esther 1 must have taken place during this time. It would make sense that he was preparing, as he was preparing for this massive assault and invasion, he would have thrown a great big banquet for his rulers, for his people that were with him, celebration to get their morale improved as he went off to fight this battle, which ended up being a losing endeavor. And it was during this time that he called on Vashti to come back and so he could display her beauty to all the princes. She refused, and he removed her from being the queen. If you look at chapter 2, though, which is the beginning and kind of a transition, there's a little bit of a gap there which could leave room for several years between the two events, the two chapters. So many people believe that those years could have been the 4 years when he was gone attacking Greece. When he returned home in 479 in defeat, the rest of the story then began to unfold. Now, if you look throughout the books of the Old Testament, you'll find the name Ahasuerus is mentioned three times. And the three different people are, in fact, not the same. So, how does that work? Well, I think if you look at a lot of the ancient sources, you'll discover that Ahasuerus is actually a title, kind of like a king in England would adopt the name to remain in a line, even though his name was something completely different. Well, Ahasuerus was a name that meant the Lion King. And even up until recently, the kings of Iran were known as the Shah, which is lion. And it was used of at least those three men, one that we commonly believe to be Xerxes. The date of the book of Esther, if you follow the traditional dates that are associated with Ahasuerus, Xerxes I, would be roughly 486 to 470 BC. So the time beginning before he went to attack Greece, the time when he came back, and the time that allowed the events to take place. Actual writing would have been at the same time because we saw that Esther's book was recorded by Mordecai, placed in a book for the Jews to keep as a record. As you progress throughout the book of Esther, there are a couple of key words that keep popping up time and time again. The first one is Jew. That's kind of interesting because the name of God isn't mentioned anywhere in the book. So to have a focus on the Jewish people, even though God's name isn't mentioned, really kind of brings the emphasis back to God and God's working throughout history, even though his name is absent. To be a Jew in these ancient times was extremely dangerous when political opinion could be easily swayed against you, especially if you consider that one man, Haman, was able to sell this entire people group for simply pledging to put, I believe it was 10,000 silver pieces in the king's treasury. So from the events in Esther, we discover that the Jews had obviously maintained a unique lifestyle even though they were in captivity. Now, why is that significant? If you look back at the rest of history, the Jews had perpetually had a problem with keeping separate. Time and time again, they were in trouble because they tried to blend in with the people of Canaan. Now that they're in Babylon, in the exile, apparently they were separate enough from the people they were living with that it was very obvious to everyone around them who was a Jew and who wasn't. Apparently, they learned their lesson a little bit too late. And that brings up a question for us. Are we remaining separate from the world. God wants us to remain separate. It's something that He has commanded us to do time and time again throughout the New Testament. Will we learn our lesson before we get into a situation where we are in trouble? A second key word is lots, or pur, and then if you make it plural in Hebrew, you add im to the end, purim. Haman, as is typical of truly superstitious people, did not lay his plans against Mordecai without determining a lucky day by casting lots. Now, in our culture here in America, it's kind of hard for us to realize the importance of determining a fortuitous day. We tend to look at luck as something of a comedy. You know, if you mention luck, it's because you're down on your luck and you wish your luck would turn. And, you know, there's not so much of a belief in it. But in these more primitive cultures and the superstitious cultures, luck rules your life, especially in an animistic culture. Like, for example, our missionaries in Southeast Asia are experiencing. Everything is done to improve your luck. So for Haman to decide on a day without getting a lucky day determined, that wouldn't have happened, especially not in ancient Persia. So, of course, he called people to come. They cast lots day by day, month by month, until they determined the 14th of Adar, the month of Adar in the Jewish calendar. At the end of the story, Mordecai and Esther proclaimed a feast named after these lots, the Feast of Purim, and said that the Jews should remember the day forever as a record they kept the book of Esther. Now, what is the Feast of Purim? It was described a little bit in those verses that we read, but the feast, the name comes from lots, but it celebrates God's deliverance of the Jews from Haman's wicked plans with a couple of primary actions. The commands given were to exchange reciprocal gifts of food and drink. So they were supposed to send gifts to each other. They were supposed to have a celebratory meal then. And also they were supposed to donate things to the poor. And a more recent trend in commemorating the Feast of Purim is that the Jews will actually read the book of Esther in their synagogues in celebration. Along with the key words, we are reminded of a doctrine that is very present in this book, and that is the doctrine of the Abrahamic covenant. If you go way back in our study, like, I don't know, 20 weeks ago, how many of you can remember last week, let alone 20 weeks ago? Yeah, me neither. So let's go ahead and look at Genesis 12 and verse 3. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3. This is one of the verses in the original giving of the Abrahamic covenant. So when God called Abraham to go to the land of Canaan, this was part of the promise that he made to him. Genesis 12 and verse 3, "And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in these shall all families of the earth be blessed." So the Abrahamic covenant clearly states that God's blessing will be upon those who bless Israel or curse for those who curse Israel. Haman was clearly Satan's tool to destroy Israel, to curse Israel, remove them from the earth. And God clearly fulfilled his promise to curse Haman, just like he had promised Abraham. The Abrahamic covenant still applies. It hasn't gone away. And I think that as a short application for us today, we should be especially cognizant of God's promise to the people of Israel that he will bless those that bless them and curse those that curse them. It might come in the future where it's no longer politically correct to support Israel, but Israel is God's chosen people. And I think if you look back through history, one of the reasons why the U.S. was so blessed immediately following World War II is that we were fighting and we liberated the Jews from Hitler and the Nazis and the Holocaust. Because of that blessing, we soon fell into other traps that are working not so good for us. But God does bless those who bless his people. So we need to make sure that we are supporting the Jews. What about the overview? So all this is kind of background, setting up the scene. Overview of the book. Let's tell the story a little bit. The first chapter is an introduction. It happened before the main characters, the rest of the main characters are introduced. It tells how the situation arose, and it tells about Ahasuerus' celebrations and Vashti's rejection as queen when she refused to come to his celebration so he could show off her beauty. Moving on to chapter 2, we are introduced to Esther and Mordecai, the two characters who supported the Jews throughout the book. We're also told how Esther went from a person in Shushan where the king lived, just a normal person, to being the queen of Persia, a very high-ranking role. We're also told at the very end of that chapter how Mordecai revealed a plot against King Ahasuerus and, as we discussed earlier, set up his own deliverance from Haman's hand later in the story. In chapter 3, we're introduced to the evil character, Haman. He is introduced as a man who very quickly becomes bitter against Mordecai. Bitter because he was proud. His pride led him astray. When the king established Haman's role, he ordained that all the people in the kingdom, the capital, should bow down to him as he was riding by. Mordecai, being a Jew, refused to bow down to him, and thereby incurred Haman's wrath because he felt that his pride had been slighted. Therefore, Haman, who was so proud he couldn't just take out his anger on Mordecai, decided he wanted to do all the Jews, get rid of all the Jews at the same time. Not just make an example of Mordecai, but kill all the Jews. And then in chapter 4, you have the reaction to Haman's plan, and moving all the way really through chapter 5. Esther and Mordecai proclaim fasting in Shushan, during which they prepare Esther for going to see the king, a potentially risky business because the king could have had her killed if he didn't want to see her. Esther then, when she went and obtained his mercy, invited the king and Haman to come to a feast that she had prepared, a banquet, and lured on by his success at this point, Haman decides to kill Mordecai in advance of the rest of the Jews. As we said earlier, no sooner did the idea occur to Haman than the king can't sleep. And when you're tired, what do? You read the books of business that you had written from your kingdom and your reign. All the records, the stuff that's really boring that no one really wants to read, but it's there if you can't fall asleep. So he called for his wise men. They came, brought the scrolls, and read to him. And they discovered Mordecai, this man that had delivered the king from an assassination plot. And God put it in the mind of King Ahasuerus to honor Mordecai. So earlier in the morning, when Haman gets up, goes to the king, and seeks his permission to kill Mordecai, the king asks Haman, "What would you do for the man that the king wants to honor?" Knowing that Haman has his own interests in mind, and probably realizing that Haman wanted to be the king, or wanted to be the man that the king wanted to honor. So Haman describes all of this good stuff. Bring the king's robe, give him the ring, have him ride through the town on the king's own horse, saluted by one of the highest ranking officers in the land, have him call out that this is the man that the king loves to honor. And then the king tells Haman, "Great, go do that for Mordecai." And you can just see Haman's face falling as he goes and performs the king's will. But through this, God delivers Mordecai and then proceeds to deliver the Jews. In the remainder of the book, chapters 7 and through 9, the first half of chapter 9, we discover how Haman's plot against the Jews is revealed by Esther as the king and Haman are at her second banquet. And then as Haman falls on his knees in front of the queen, begging for his life, the king decides to have him killed on the very same gallows that he was preparing for Mordecai. In exchange, the king was missing a ruler. And he called Mordecai, set up Mordecai in Haman's place, and gave Haman's house to Esther. After that, it was a matter of time for Esther and Mordecai to develop a response for the king to sign and send off to all the Jews so that they could defend themselves from Haman's plot. And then we are told about the Feast of Purim. The 14th day of the 12th month is made a day of rest and celebration to commemorate God's deliverance. And Esther's command is written in a book, the book of Esther, I believe. We're concluding then with chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. And I'd like to go ahead and read this since you should be in Esther still. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea. But then these next two verses, and all the acts of his power and of his might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next unto the king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, speaking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. So Mordecai the Jew was next to the king. If you remember last week, we talked about Nehemiah being the king's cupbearer. If you look at the timeline through history, Mordecai would have come before Nehemiah. And we also discussed that the cupbearer was the closest position to the king, the one who alone was able to be next to the king at feasts, the one who controlled, who came in, had the petitions presented to the king, and also that the role of cupbearer was hereditary a lot of times, passed down from family to family. So it might be possible even that this is how Nehemiah wound up in the position of cupbearer and was ready to take on the responsibility of building the walls of Jerusalem. Going even back to Mordecai and his greatness, the loss of Haman, raising up of Esther to be queen. So God's hand is always at work to prepare events in the future. Challenges to Esther. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but why is God not mentioned anywhere in the book? That could be a serious challenge that somebody could raise against the book of Esther, because it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't have God. It kind of seems a bit strange. Does this apparent absence threaten the truth of the book? And really, I don't think it does. And the simple answer, no. Why not? Well, the events of Esther are clearly orchestrated by the divine hand of God, even though his name is never mentioned. I think that God's hand is very clearly displayed as you read the book of Esther, even though the proper name is never given. And then furthermore, the book contrasts two types of God's people. Esther, who was oblivious to God's hand and had to be directed into the path of his will, and Mordecai, who quickly realized that God had provided a possible solution before the problem had materialized and then directed Esther in how to fulfill that. The book of Esther, if we capitalize on these similarities between our own lives and what is recorded there, can give us encouragement today to look at our own lives and see how God in his hand is working for us. Although we may not have the current advantage to be able to look back, look at everything, and see the whole story of how God has orchestrated events, forestalled problems that we're going to face before they even come up, protected us, we will one day. You know, perhaps one day when we get to heaven, we'll get to sit back on a really comfy chair, pop in the DVD of our lives, watch it on 5K, and then 5K resolution and see, oh my goodness, I never realized all that God was doing for me all along the way. I never realized when he protected me on that day. There was, you know, I was just 30 seconds too soon on the interstate or something like that. And what has God been doing for you that you don't get to see until the events are brought up? God has not ceased to work events out for good in the lives of his children. Romans 8:28, I think, is a good verse to conclude our lesson on tonight. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are the called according to his purpose. When was the last time you sat still long enough to think about all that God has done for you and the events in your life? You know, if you want to be able to see where your life is going and you want to be able to see what God has done, you have to think about who God is and how that is reflected in your life. When was the last time you recognized God working all things for your good? He's been doing it if you're a Christian. If you sit down and think through events in your life, I'm sure that you'll be able to come up with some. So our application tonight is, remember that God works all things for good to those who love him. You know, back to our chess game illustration, sometimes we can get distracted by all the little things that happen. You know, when your enemy slides the pawn forward and puts your king in check, even though it's not really the end of the world, you have a piece that can take it, you're not realizing then that he's really moving to attack around the side. Sometimes the little movements can distract us. We don't even realize that the full picture is that little movement opens up God's ability to give us the power to overcome Satan in an aspect of our lives. But tonight, let's make sure to remember that even those tiny movements, those tiny oppositions, no matter how big they might seem to us in our flesh, remember that those tiny antagonisms from Satan have a purpose in God's design for our lives. Remember that he is always working everything to the good of those that love him. But remembering involves an initial aspect, an initial noticing of what God is doing. You have to think about what God is doing in your life if you want to remember. But I do want to include a caution. The promise that God is working all things for our good does not necessarily mean that we will be able to look right now and see everything. That could be an error that someone would fall into. And then when you don't see it, when you don't understand, cause you to rebel or turn away from God in disillusionment. But even if we can't see it right now, it may take our entire lives before we truly realize what God has done for us. But be patient, because he is working. And that's a promise that we have from the Word of God. Remember that God works all things for good to those that love him. And that is it for tonight. So thank you very much for coming. Let's go ahead and divide up for prayer.